streaming live on the web, as usual, at voanews.com. I'm joined in the studio now by Carla Babb, who's our Pentagon correspondent. Ban Ki-moon, they're really setting the scene for the General Assembly, obviously touching on a lot of issues. We heard there about Ebola. We heard about refugee issues. I wanted to get the latest from you on the Pentagon, what's happening right now over the skies of Iraq and Syria.
Another day, more strikes. There have been four strikes over the past day in Iraq. There have been an extra strike in Syria, about 20 total now. And then we're approaching 200. I think the final tally is a little under 200, but we're approaching 200 airstrikes in Iraq.
We have heard in the past 24 hours about this new coalition. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, most of these states, it seems to me, have already chosen a side. Is that underplaying it? Am I not giving them enough credit?
Well, a coalition is important. It's good to point out that, yes, these are nations that have a big interest in the United States military. I mean, you've got bases in some of these countries. You've got other countries that have a huge refugee problem with the situation in Syria, so they do have a side to take already. But the fact that President Obama was able to gather a coalition of Arab states that have a vested interest in this issue in Syria, in this issue in Iraq, does give it more credibility.
What do you think the military, and we had spoke about 2 weeks ago live here at Voice America when we were covering the last president's address, and we talked about the U.S. military taking the gloves off and there being a sort of need within certain circles at the Pentagon to go after these targets. Has that happened now?
It's happening. There are still some setbacks if you were looking at it at a military standpoint. They have not targeted ISIL leaders directly. Admiral Kirby, Lieutenant General Mayfield made it very clear that they were not targeting specific individuals yet. Whether or not that will happen is usually a matter of time. You see what happened with the Al-Shabaab leader. But for now, their goal, as the U.S. military puts it, is to protect the Iraqi forces, to protect the Kurdish forces, give them space, was their direct quote, so they can do their job against the Islamic State militants.
How big of a concern at the Pentagon is civilian casualties? This came up in the briefing yesterday. You raised it with the admiral. I know that he didn't really give you a direct answer. He wasn't really in a position to do so. But being there, being based at the Pentagon, how are you reading that? It must be a concern when you look at sort of how things have unfolded in Pakistan, for example.
Right. They're very clear on this. And yes, they were not aware of civilian casualties when I asked the question yesterday. But they went to great pains to show reporters at the briefings yesterday, here is what we're doing. We are targeting these specific areas. They gave us an example of one place where they wanted to target the rooftop communications. So they showed a before photo of the building and they showed an after photo saying, look, the building is still standing. We only targeted this specific area. They showed another area, which was a training facility, and they showed as the bombs were going off. And when you saw the bombs go off, you saw that it all fit into that perimeter, all in that one area. So they do not want civilian casualties in this. They want to only target Islamic State militants.
You can see there from the video, and if you're listening to us on the radio, we're showing the most recent pictures out of Iraq and Syria of some of the damage caused by some of these strikes. We're joined by Richard Gowan in New York City. He's a research director at New York University, a senior fellow for the European Council on Foreign Relations. Richard, thank you for being with us. I want to actually read a paragraph of your article that appeared in Politico magazine. It's actually the first paragraph. I think it's fantastic. When ardent atheists approach the end of their lives, they often discover a belated interest in religion, you write. Something similar happens to American presidents. On entering their twilight years in office, they hit a last-minute interest in the United Nations. Is that happening to this U.S. president? What do you expect today?
Barack Obama has always been instinctively friendly towards the UN, but he actually hasn't worked through the organization very effectively in recent years, mainly because he's been struggling with Russia and China over Syria and Ukraine. This year, he's coming back to the UN. There's a big push by the administration to show that the US really does care about the UN, and there's a particular focus on two issues. One of those is Ebola, and the other is the situation in Iraq and Syria.
How do you keep the focus on things like the Ukraine, on issues like Ebola at the United Nations when you're already carrying out bombing campaigns in Iraq and Syria?
I think that the Obama administration thinks that the UN is a useful ally in dealing with Iraq and Syria, but it recognizes that a lot of the nasty work of fighting the Islamic State is not going to go through the UN or through the Security Council. By contrast, the US mission to the UN over the last 2 weeks has been making a huge push on Ebola. And there is a real understanding, both in Washington and at the US mission here in New York, that to fight Ebola, you need the World Health Organization, you need UN peacekeepers, you need UN humanitarian agencies. It's a problem that requires a multinational response, and the UN is best placed to deliver that.
Richard, stick with us. I wanna just ask very briefly, Carla, on this issue, on Ebola. I know the US military is now involved. What's the latest you're hearing on that front?
Well, they are telling us that the people, they're gonna have 3,000 troops, you know, give or take, on the ground. And they're saying that these are gonna come from all different areas because it can't just come from Africa. There's not enough just to come from Africa. So this is going to be a huge undertaking. So when you add that on top of everything that's going on, the United States is really reaching out to the international community. And I think Obama is gonna highlight all of that and say, we are out there helping. We need more people out there helping.
Richard, does the UN need a win here? Does it need a victory? It seems, and I've heard you sort of reference this, that the mission that took place recently in Syria has been viewed by many as a bit of a failure. Is Ebola potentially an area where the UN can excel, especially given the boots that it already has on the ground in Africa?
Yes, I mean, the UN already has 4,500 troops in Liberia, for example, which is the epicenter of the Ebola crisis. The UN does need a win. The Syrian crisis has been a horrible, horrible experience for the organization. And UN peacekeepers were not able to help in Syria. UN aid agencies are struggling in Syria. It's a problem that has shown all the weaknesses of the organization. Similarly, the UN is pretty much paralyzed over Ukraine because of Russia's veto in the Security Council. Ebola is a very different case. There is no pro-Ebola country in the world. Russia and China don't want to see Ebola succeed. And so Ban Ki-moon, in the speech that we heard just now, was clearly emphasizing that Ebola was a cause that could bring the organization together. And I think that Ban is investing personally in the fight against the disease, and I think the president will as well.
For our radio listeners, again, this is Voice of America live from Washington. For those of you watching us on voanews.com, those were recent pictures out of Liberia. Richard Gowan is with us from New York City. Carla Babb here in studio, based at the Pentagon. And we continue to check in at the UN Assembly there in New York. We are standing by waiting for the Brazilian president, who should be starting shortly. Carla, on this issue of Ebola, does the U.S. military think, and I'm sure that they do they think they can make a difference? Do they want to get in there?
They do. They would not be there if they didn't feel that they could make a difference. And they feel that what they've done so far, they're already there trying to build one facility to treat patients. They know that that's not enough. This is too big for just one facility, just, you know, a couple dozen troops coming in. So they're going, and this is a massive effort. This is enough to say, we care so much that we're going to send people from all over the world to stop this, because if we don't stop it, it's going to spread. And if it spreads, it can be a threat to the homeland.
Richard, is the UN going to take the lead on this? The video out of Liberia, the video from these places is obviously shocking to a lot of people. The new numbers from the CDC saying basically if people in West Africa don't change their behavior and if the global community doesn't do more, we could be looking at over 1 million people infected. Are we going to see blue helmets on the ground soon?
Well, as I say, there are already blue helmets in Liberia. There are blue helmets over the border in Cote d'Ivoire. The UN has a great deal of experience of peacekeeping and stabilization missions in West Africa over the last decade. It's quite possible that if state structures start to crumble and collapse across the region, that the UN will have to send in more troops, more police, to replace the governments. Now, it will be very difficult to find countries that are willing to put soldiers into states where there's a very high risk of getting Ebola. And so it's essential that the US and the UN do as much as they can now to prevent the disease spreading, rather than letting it grow further and then having to clear up the mess.
Before we check in with the UN General Assembly, I do want to stick with Africa for a little bit here. At what point, Richard, does it become very, very complicated when you look at the security situation that's happening in Eastern Africa, when you look at the peacekeeping force that is right now in Somalia, that African Union force? It's getting pretty tricky.
The UN peacekeeping system has 70 to 80,000 personnel in Africa. The African Union has many thousands more troops in Somalia. It is becoming increasingly difficult to find the troops and military assets you need to deal with crises like those in South Sudan and the Central African Republic. And I think one tragedy facing the UN today is that there is such a focus on Ukraine, there is such a focus on Syria, that some of the big crises in Africa are not getting sufficient attention. At the start of this year, we were all talking about South Sudan. We were talking about CAR. Samantha Power, as US ambassador to the UN, was really trying to focus attention on CAR. But although Ban did just mention those crises in his speech, they're really now off the international radar. And it's a tragic but familiar tale. Major humanitarian crises in Africa often get forgotten when there are smaller but higher political crises elsewhere in the world.
And for the United States military, I know as they're planning to go in more and more in Liberia, appearances matter to this area because they know that the United States military has an image of going in and occupying, going in with guns. And so the United States military has made it clear to reporters, and we've pushed on this, that they're not carrying guns. This is just going to be a setup mission, but then that leaves people vulnerable. So there's a balance that you have to work with to try to make sure that the people who are helping are safe, but the appearances are still kept so it's not looking like an invading force.
And that's obviously a balance that the U.S. president is trying to strike in New York on this day. Again, we're standing by waiting for the Brazilian president to start her speech. She will be followed by President Barack Obama. We were expecting him in about 15 minutes. That will probably slide. It usually does during these events. Richard, I would like to go back to you, and if I could, maybe just pivot back to the situation in Iraq and in Syria. The U.S. is obviously heavily invested financially at the United Nations. Is there anything the U.N. Can do to help the U.S. president on this front?
I think the U.S. has concluded that the main fight against the Islamic State has to be carried out through a coalition of the willing, and primarily a coalition of Arab states. And we've seen the UAE and Saudi Arabia and other Arab states supporting this week's airstrikes. What the UN can do is primarily humanitarian. There's a huge need for aid to displaced people and refugees in Iraq and Syria. There's a huge need for food and other forms of assistance. And President Obama has said that he wants to ensure that there is sufficient humanitarian assistance to Iraq as the military campaign goes on. So I think that's the number one thing that the UN can offer in the Middle East right now. It's basic humanitarian assistance to the thousands and hundreds of thousands of civilians who have been, have had their lives shattered by the rise of ISIS.
And we heard the Secretary General talking about these huge numbers of refugees, the largest number of, as he put it, refugees and asylum seekers since the Second World War. Richard, on this issue of airstrikes, you know, and we've heard this phrase this week, the cart in front of the horse, starting airstrikes before addressing the UNGA, obviously not something that bothers the administration. They obviously have said to the American people this was a pressing need, that there was a security issue. Do you think he's going to find any resistance at the United Nations?
I think that most leaders at the UN understand what the U.S. has done. And I don't think there's going to be a huge amount of criticism of American policy, except from some of the usual suspects like Cuba, for example. The Russians and Chinese will probably press the US to respect Syrian sovereignty. They will make the case that to fight the Islamic State, we should actually work in collaboration with Bashar al-Assad rather than continuing to try and sideline him. That will be a controversial point. But more broadly, the Islamic State has created such a wave of fear in the international system that I expect that President Obama will not encounter too much public criticism in New York.
This is something that's, to me, a fascinating point, this issue of Bashar al-Assad. And for people, I'm assuming, at the Pentagon, it's not a lesser of two evils choice. It's a we'd prefer not to make a choice at all. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And Kirby, and Admiral Kirby's opening statement yesterday, he said, we did not work with Assad. We did not contact him and try to ask for his help. We did this alone. We did this unilaterally. And then we worked with five Arab nations and listed them, not Syria included, when we went in against the Islamic State. They've made that very clear. And I think that the stressor for this UN General Assembly is that the training of the Syrian rebels is going to be a months-long process, months away. The strikes are immediate, and the strikes are only against the Islamic State. They're not against the Assad government. So when he's working to build this coalition, he's not going to get the resistance from the Assad supporters because he's not targeting Assad. If anything, right now, the strikes are helping Assad.
Richard, as somebody who watches the UN very closely, you know, today's speech is part theater, I guess, probably not the right word, but what is happening on the sidelines today that people need to know about? What is happening on the sidelines that's going to be impactful? There's a number of meetings taking place, I know, on the sidelines of these speeches.
There's always a huge amount of diplomatic activity around the UN General Assembly. And this week we have a lot of talks on the Middle East. There are discussions with the Iranians. There will be further events on the Ebola crisis. The sense that the organization is overwhelmed by the number of challenges it faces today is very, very strong. And I think that a lot of ministers and a lot of presidents and prime ministers will be hoping that they can come back from New York saying, we haven't saved the world, but at least we've restored some sense of order after a very, very difficult year. The one crisis that I don't think you will see seriously addressed or meaningfully addressed is that in Ukraine, because the divisions between Russia and the US are such that no consensus is possible in New York on how to deal with the situation in eastern Ukraine.
So as somebody who studies the European community very closely, people aren't going to touch it because there's just such a vast difference between the two parties? Is that what you're saying?
There may be some discussion of the issue, but I don't think we're going to see a solution to the Ukrainian crisis coming out of New York. The Security Council has discussed Ukraine many, many times over the last year. The Russians have called debates on Ukraine, so have the US. But every single time, it's just a rhetorical standoff. There's no serious diplomacy on the issue.
It's almost impossible to imagine that something like the Ukraine wouldn't rate, you know, at this moment with everything that's going on, but that's clearly what's happening. We're taking a look at those live pictures out of the UN General Assembly, some procedural matters going on. We're standing by waiting for the Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff. She is being introduced right now. You see her walking to the podium. Let's listen in.
Ambassador Sam Kutesa, President of the 69th United Nations General Assembly, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations Organization, Your Excellencies, Ladies and Gentlemen, Heads of State and Heads of Government, Ladies and Gentlemen, for Brazil, as the country that has the honor and the privilege to open this debate, it is a great pleasure to see at the presidency of this General Assembly, a son of Africa. We Brazilians are attached to the African continent through historic, cultural, and friendship ties. Africa's contribution was and remains decisive to the very makeup of my country's national identity. Mr. President, I open this general debate just a few days before elections are held in Brazil, elections that will choose the president of the republic, state governors, and a substantial part of our legislative branch of power. The upcoming elections are the celebration of a democracy that we achieved almost 30 years following two decades of dictatorial governments. With democracy, We have also made much progress by way of economic stabilization. In the past 12 years in particular, we have added yet another gain to these achievements. I'm talking particularly about the consolidation of an inclusive society based on equal opportunities. The major transformation to which we have been committed has produced a modern economy and a more egalitarian society. At the same time, it has required strong and active involvement of our people, respect to human rights, and a sustainable vision for our development. Lastly, it has also required action on the global scene based on the multilateral approach, respect to international law, the quest for peace, and the practice of solidarity. Mr. President, a few days ago, the FAO indicated that Brazil has come out of the so-called hunger map. That change is the result of an economic policy that has created 21 million jobs and has appreciated the value of basic wage by increasing its purchasing power by 71% in the past 12 years, as a result of which we have reduced inequality. 36 million Brazilians have been uplifted from extreme poverty since 2003, 22 million of which under my administration alone. Social and income transfer policies have also contributed to that result, policies that were brought together as part of the Brazil Free of Extreme Poverty Plan. On the healthcare front, we have succeeded in achieving the goal of reducing child mortality before the deadline set by the MDGs. We have also made access to fundamental, primary, and middle education universally available. We have pursued the same objective in secondary education. We stand committed to improving the quality of education by enhancing curricular contents and appreciating the role and the value of the teaching profession. Vocational education has made headway as hundreds of new schools have been opened, together with the training and development of 8 million young people in the past 4 years. There has been an unprecedented expansion of higher education. New public universities and more than 3 million students have been granted scholarships and funding, which in turn have ensured access to private universities. Affirmative actions have enabled massive access by poor, black, and indigenous students to university programs. Furthermore, the challenges involved in building a knowledge society have brought about our Science Without Borders program, a program through which more than 100,000 undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate students are sent to the world's finest universities. By means of a presidential initiative, Congress in Brazil passed a law that allocates to education 75% of royalties and 50% of the reserve fund of the pre-salt oil deposits, plus another 25% to healthcare. We will change finite, non-renewable resources such as oil and gas into a permanent asset, i.e., education, scientific and technological knowledge, and innovation. This, as such, will be our passport to the future. Mr. President, we have not neglected fiscal soundness and monetary stability, and we have protected Brazil in view of external volatility. Accordingly, we have been able to provide responses to the wide-ranging world economic crisis triggered in 2008, a crisis involving the international financial system that started following the collapse of the Lehman Brothers Bank, which later became, in many countries, a sovereign debt crisis. We have withstood its worst consequences: unemployment, wage reduction, loss of social rights, and investments that were ground to a halt. We then continued to distribute income by stimulating growth and employment while upholding investments in infrastructure. Brazil left the 13th position in the overall ranking to become the world's seventh largest economy. Per capita income has more than tripled. Inequality has fallen sharply. If in 2002 more than half of Brazilians were either poor or very poor, today, by contrast, 3 out of every 4 Brazilians are part and parcel of the middle class and the upper classes in society. During the crisis, while worldwide hundreds of millions of workers were losing their jobs, Brazil created 12 million formal job posts. Moreover, we have consolidated ourselves as one of the main destinations of foreign investments. We have resumed infrastructure investments through a strong partnership with the private sector. All of these gains and achievements are being materialized in an environment of fiscal soundness. We have reduced our net debt to GDP ratio from about 60% to 35% of the GDP. The foreign or the gross foreign debt vis-a-vis the GDP fell from 42% down to 14%. International reserves increased tenfold, and we have therefore become international creditors. The yearly inflation rate has also been within the boundaries of the minimum and maximum variation range set under the inflation targeting system in effect in Brazil. Mr. President, although we have managed to withstand the most harmful consequences of the global crisis, the fact is that it has nevertheless affected us, and more acutely so, in the past few years. This is due to the fact that in all regions of the world, there remains a lingering and considerable economic difficulty, which have had a negative impact on our growth pattern. May I reiterate what I said here at the opening of the general debate? It is essential and urgent to resume momentum of the global economy. It should work as a driver of investments and a tool to foster international trade and reduce inequalities among countries, and not as a factor that will ultimately slow down the pace of economic development and income distribution through society at large. As regards international trade, all parties must be committed to a work program aimed at successfully completing the Doha round. It is also imperative, Mr. President, to put an end to the current mismatch between the increasing importance of developing countries in the world's economy and their insufficient participation in the decision-making processes of international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. The delay in expanding the voting powers of developing countries in these institutions is unacceptable. The risk facing these institutions is that they may ultimately lose their legitimacy and efficiency. Mr. Chairman, rather Mr. President, Brazil was utterly pleased to host the 6th BRICS summit meeting. We received the leaders of China, India, Russia, and South Africa in a most fraternal and fruitful meeting, which pointed clearly to an important future outlook. On the occasion, we signed agreements establishing the new development bank and the contingent reserve agreement. The new bank will cater to the infrastructure financing needs of the BRICS and those of developing countries. The contingent reserve agreement, in turn, will provide protection to BRICS countries from financial volatility. Each instrument will involve a capital injection of $100 billion. Mr. President, the current generation of world leaders, i.e. our generation, has also been called upon to overcome substantial challenges involving the topics of peace, collective security, and the environment. We have nevertheless been unable to solve old disputes and to prevent new threats. The use of force cannot possibly eliminate the deep-seated causes of conflicts. That is made plain and clear in the lingering and unsolved Palestinian issue. It is also made clear in the systematic massacre of the Syrian people, in the tragic nationwide fragmentation of Iraq, as well as in the serious state of insecurity in Libya, in the conflicts in the Sahel, as well as in the clashes in Ukraine. In every military intervention, we have not moved towards peace. Instead, we have witnessed increasingly hard-fought conflicts. There has been a tragic multiplication in the number of civilian victims, and countless cases of humanitarian plight. We cannot accept that these barbaric expressions of lawlessness increase and thus violate our ethical, moral, and civilizational values. Neither can we remain indifferent to the spread of the Ebola virus in Western Africa. Accordingly, we support the proposal put forth by the Secretary General to establish the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response.